The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's the start of a brand new week here on The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio, your number one local radio station. It's Monday the 8th of June 2026 and we're just approaching 4 minutes past nine. Loads coming up on the show and I say that because it's true. We've got so much to keep you informed and entertained over the next 2 hours. And we want to discuss what you want to talk about as well. So if there's an issue you wish to raise, some news that you wish to pass on, maybe an act of kindness, whatever it might be, well, the lines are open for you right now. Caroline Orr, researcher and producer, assisted by Shannon Wilkin, 086 60 25000. That's a WhatsApp and that is our text number. If you want to give us a call, feel free, 074 91 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. We're a radio show, but we've got a visual presentation for you as well. You can watch the whole blooming thing. Just go onto YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. Type in Highland Radio Ireland on YouTube, either on your laptop, your mobile devices, or your smart TV, Fire Stick, your Google Streamer, and we are there. You can watch us on your big screen TV if that suits you. And we're also across the Facebook pages as well. Right, now let's see what's making the headlines in the papers today. We'll start with the locals and the Donegal News. Still tapping into that public anger out there that Donegal v Cork will not be on the telly. It'll not be streamed. I gave my views on this last week. RTE and the GEA have been challenged to explain a disgraceful snub amid a TV blackout of next Saturday's Crunch All-Ireland meeting of Dublin and Cork. The county is fighting for automatic qualification to this year's championship quarterfinals in a high-profile contest which marks a first homecoming match at Ballybuffet's McCool Park since a €500,000 renovation. But GEA fans' fury was sparked when it was revealed that the biggest Donegal match of the season so far will controversially not be televised on either RTE, which charges a €160 licence fee, or the annual €95 GEA Plus subscription service. It's not on telly, but to remind you, you can listen to it in its entirety, as you always can. Build up live coverage reaction here on Highland Radio with the two Brendans and Oisin, and one of those Brendans, Brendan Devaney, will be joining us later this morning to preview tonight's DL debate, which I presume is going to be dedicated to a great extent to next week's game and all the ramifications of that. There's a lot of Northwest interest next weekend, of course. The Derry News reports that the Western Health and Social Care Trust, which currently has 26 identified risks on the corporate risk register, has moved to reassure the public. According to the Corporate Risk Register and Assurance Framework briefing note prepared for the Trust Board meeting on May 7th, 2026, the 26 risks were approved at the Trust Board meeting of March 5th, 2026. I must read that in detail a little bit later. I don't fully understand that story, but I'll read a bit deeper a little later on. We've discussed Jenny's Law on this programme extensively over recent years, and Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan, according to the Irish Independent, will publish new legislation this week that will set up a public register to list the names of those with a conviction for domestic violence against a partner or former partner. The legislation is named in honour of Jenny Poole, who was murdered by her ex-partner Gavin Murphy in 2020. She was not aware he had a previous conviction for assaulting a former partner. Mr. O'Callaghan received Cabinet approval in October to draft the new law, and this week the Cabinet is expected to approve the publication of the text of the bill and begin immediate passage through the Dáil and Shannon. So this is going to be a very extensive register. We know the level of domestic violence there is in this country. There's just no doubt that it is epidemic at this stage. Is there any downside to this, or is the fact that we're talking about avoiding potentially people being the victims of domestic violence in the future, does that cover all? So in other words, there's no downside to this at all, or is or do you foresee any problems with this type of register? Like, how long are you on it for? You know, at what time is your, you know, your record clear? Does it have to be recent? All of that will have to be made clear to us, of course. But again, sort of the overriding thing is domestic violence is so bad that maybe it doesn't really matter. Well, the bill, which will be known as Jenny's Law, will provide for the names of those convicted of domestic violence against a partner or former partner to be included on a public register as part of the conviction process. The public register will be hosted on a website of the court service, and survivors will be required to provide consent before the convicted person can be named on the register. So they'll have to be very clear, obviously, with overlapping names. They'll have to be very clear as to how they identify someone. If you know where I'm saying, like if it was, I don't know, pick a name, John Gallagher, for example. Greg Hughes, not so much, although maybe it'd be more difficult with Greg Hughes because there's so few of them. But, I mean, you'd have to be very clear in how you can identify the person so that someone doesn't get misidentified. You know, and then that gets shared around, you know, Greg Hughes is a this, that and done. So, again, how do you make sure when you provide that detail that you are clear that it's this person and not person B, C or D? This comes up from time and time again, and there's a serious concern about baby sleep pillows and the danger they pose to babies. And the reason I'm mentioning it again, because, you know, we cover this from time to time, and maybe this is the one show people listen to and they're pushed online or on Amazon or wherever they are, and just to get the message out there to potentially avoid the most awful heartache could be visited on anyone. Well, parents and those looking after infant children have been warned not to buy or use pillows marked as baby sleep accessories as they prove a risk of death through either suffocation or overheating. The Competition and Consumer Protection Agency has issued the warning after establishing that the products are being made available for sale to Irish consumers, mainly through online marketplaces. It said it had issued takedown notices that have so far prompted the removal of 1,115 listings of these products from AI Express, or is it? It's AI. I've never used AI. It's AliExpress, isn't it? I've never used it, though. Amazon and a couple of others. A spokesperson said CCPC product safety officers continued to engage with online marketplaces to ensure that these products marked for sleep and use in cots with babies were removed. So as I say, this has been going on for years, but you just never know when, you know, you might think you're doing the best thing in the world or making your baby really comfortable because an advert says, but just be really, really cautious and read up, please, if you are a new mom or dad and you see these baby sleep pillows, because they do present a proper risk of suffocation or overheating. Let's not forget, babies aren't very good at regulating their own temperatures, the same as older people aren't, so... a bit of controversy from Friday, and it's in relation to a question in this year's Leaving Cert. You might think this is the best thing ever, or you might think it's not right, or you might be nonplussed, you might not care. But a question about a pregnant person on this year's Leaving Cert has sparked a political row, with critics accusing the state of bringing culture wars into the exam hall. The wording appeared on this week's Applied Leaving Certificate social education paper. Beneath a photograph of a pregnant woman, although they're presuming it was a pregnant woman, the fifth question asked students, besides taking folic acid, describe two positive lifestyle changes a pregnant person should make to protect the unborn child. A question about a pregnant person is one of this year's Leaving Cert exams, and it sparked a row. What do you think about that? Maybe it's something, as I say, you're not too pushed on. I think if I were a woman, I wouldn't really like being referred to as a pregnant person. But that's me, and I'm not a woman, so I can't speak on behalf of women. So they've decided to use pregnant person rather than pregnant woman, and it's been criticised by some politicians. One said they had been contacted by a teacher who felt the wording was an affront to the rights and dignity of biological women. Now, there is a massive conversation happening in the United States, Britain and elsewhere about... this space. It's lagging here, but I do note that it is being talked about here and there. Maybe you don't mind, maybe you think it's an affront to women, or maybe you don't care. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. Are you happy with the phraseology of a pregnant person for the Leaving Cert exam rather than woman? Now, this is a story relating to University Hospital Limerick, but I know that it is a story for many, many hospitals right across the country. And it's how our older people are being treated in hospital and the level of care that they are receiving. In this instance, a pensioner with severe high blood pressure was discharged from hospital in the small hours of the morning despite protests by medics and refused readmission to her nursing home. The patient, who is nearly 80, was removed from University Hospital Limerick at around 1:30 a.m. in April. It happened despite protests from nurses and other healthcare professionals over her condition at the country's most overcrowded hospital. The decision to discharge the patient was made even though her systemic blood pressure was over 180. And this is the top number read on the blood pressure monitor. Anything over 140 is considered high pressure. So you can imagine really how the family must feel that their health doesn't really matter. You would never, I don't think, would you ever discharge someone of with a blood pressure reading the top number of 180. In spite of the concern, the doctors involved decided on her release to a nearby nursing home. So really, I suppose the question I want to ask is do you know, maybe you've had older people in care in acute hospitals. Do you feel that they get the care that they deserve as the people really, if it wasn't for us, you know, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be here at all. Do we give the proper care to older people when they need it? Or sometimes do you get a sense that, is it worth treating them? You know, do they get is the same level of scrutiny over their care? Let me know if you've any experiences about that. As I say, people talk to me about that kind of stuff off air. Maybe it's something you want to bring on air. 086 60 25,000. And weight loss drugs are proving to be very beneficial for people who need to lose weight or for those who want to lose weight. And there's more and more evidence that their health benefits are go beyond the loss of weight. And it's more and more studies. So it's not just one ad hoc study of 40 people in North Canada, right? These are proper studies. And also I note that there's a new version of these weight loss drugs to be released in the next year or two that actually burns fat as well. It's been designed to burn fat as well, not just suppress someone's appetite. So someone would be feeling less hungry, but also this drug would help them burn fat. But weight loss and diabetes jabs, and they are diabetes jabs, should be probed as potential cancer prevention agents, scientists say. A study found injections used to tackle obesity and type 2 diabetes, including Mounjaro, Wegovy and Ozempic, may have wider benefits for one's health. US experts studied data on more than 161,000 patients who were obese but did not have diabetes and had not been diagnosed with an obesity-related cancer. Of those, half used one of the new drugs while the rest were given a consultation on diet and exercise. Analysts revealed that those who took the GLP-1 medication displayed a 41% reduced risk of obesity-related cancer. That's massive. It's massive for individuals. It's massive for families. It's massive for health services as well. So if it does turn out that they have those type of effects, I think really what it's actually proving is what we've known already, that the disease that is obesity is responsible for, you know, a daisy chain of diseases as well. And if you can tackle the obesity like these drugs do really effectively, it would seem, then you lower the risk of contraction of obesity-related diseases such as cancer. My next guest, first guest in fact, today is in studio with me, Siobhan Cullen, Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Consultant, specialising in equality and also works in international protection. Good morning to you, Siobhan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg, and thanks for having me.
We're speaking in a broad context, but not least in an Ireland Think survey published at the weekend that showed immigration is now a key concern for 27% of voters, up 7 points on the previous poll. And it's, of course, coming ahead of the introduction of the EU Migration and Asylum Pact, which is causing, promoting a lot of conversation, mostly online. 27% of voters, it's not the majority. What does that figure say to you?
Well, I genuinely think that we need to look at immigration in a more positive way. However, it doesn't surprise me that a lot of people have concerns, and some of them are genuine concerns, but I also think there are a lot of misconceptions out there and a lot of myths that are being put out on social media, for example, that are really influencing the way people view immigration. And they have misconceptions that most people coming here are asylum seekers and they're not working. And actually, that's not the case. The majority of immigrants who come here are working with work permits and visas. And it surprises surprise me because the Irish culture, you know, has a long history of emigration across the world. I think 10 million people in total. But I do think that maybe the Irish communities are not used to cultural diversity.
But are you not doing what those you talk of are doing now? You're conflating a little bit there because the Irish that generally went away did go away to work. And the majority of immigrants that are coming here are coming to work. But it's really those aren't the people that are often talked about online, is it? It's those that maybe have come here and they can't work or they can't work for a while. You know, it's those coming here for protection.
Yes, of course. And there are some people coming here for protection. So the majority of people coming here are coming here to work. But the people coming for protection, I think there's a bit of a misconception that we're doing a favour to somebody. We're actually complying with international law and with human rights and, you know, international human rights and EU human rights. And of course, Irish people over the years, and currently there are 1.5 million Irish people who have emigrated, who are living abroad. And most are working, of course, but some won't be for various personal reasons. I just think we have to have a more positive outlook in terms of immigration and look at the benefits, the short-term and the long-term benefits of immigration in Ireland.
Well, you know, there's a lot of negativity about that before people jump on and think this is some sort of a whitewash. Listen, it's good to get a balance and people should hear different perspectives. So what do you think are some of the key misconceptions out there?
Well, the ESRI did a survey this year, Economic Social Research Institute, and they found that the biggest misconception related to numbers. So the majority of people felt that there were a lot more immigrants arriving in Ireland than there actually are, and also the work issue. So people genuinely believe that the majority of immigrants arriving in Ireland are asylum seekers. Actually, that's not the case. Mm. It's a relatively small number. So I'll give you a couple of figures. For example, from last year, 125,000 people arrived in Ireland. Which sounds like a large number. It was a 16% decrease from the previous year. But 25% of those were Irish citizens returning. So that's one in four. And then 20% were EU citizens. And I think people sometimes forget the fact that we have freedom of movement in the EU. I can go and live in Amsterdam today and you can go and live in France. And, you know, we have that as part of our EU membership. And yet 51% of those 125,000 people did come from non-EU countries, but not as asylum seekers. The majority had work permits. Mm-hmm. There's about 16,000 to 20,000 per year who are asylum seekers. So I think that's one of the big misconceptions,
yeah,
is
and
figures.
And I have actually read those figures out in this programme before to try and put some of this into context. Mm. The problem also, too, is that if there is a lot of anger, say, for instance, towards those that are coming here, you know, seeking asylum, and you would argue there shouldn't be that anger because it's their right and we've signed up for this. What happens is, and what I've heard from people who have lived here, maybe second generation or have lived here 10, 15 years, working in local healthcare, whatever it might be, it changes a public sentiment to people who look different across the board.
Yes.
You know, do you know what I mean? So in other words, if you it starts with a little kernel of anger towards immigration, maybe there might be a crime and that's amplified compared to, say, for instance, if it was a white Irish person. But then what happens is everyone who's not white, you know, all of a sudden they can become targets of racism where it didn't exist, you know.
Absolutely.
5, 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, absolutely.
I haven't articulated that well, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Oh, I totally agree. And, you know, at the moment, you know, the population in Ireland is 5.5 million. 84% of people are from Irish origin. And so the number of people, the demographics are changing, and the number of people who are not from Irish origin originally, you know, that is increasing. And you would think, wouldn't you, Greg, that that would increase cultural diversity and raise awareness and actually be beneficial. You know, the Irish have brought great cultural changes into other countries. in terms of, you know, everything from sort of music to other cultural differences. But people tend to be looking at it a bit negatively rather than looking at it in the long term. This is going to be beneficial to the community and, you know, increase cultural diversity.
Have we seen, or is there an example, as far as you would see, of a country that we'd be familiar with where that picture that you paint about an increase in people coming in from different countries, you know, creating a more rounded culture? Because if I look at the United States, for an example, there are serious issues with you know, the lack of integration, mm-hmm. anger amongst certain groups. In Britain, for an example, you will have certain parts of Birmingham, Leeds, whatever, where you know, that small percentage that are from outside of England congregate and are there. Like, is there an example that you know of internationally where the mixing of cultures actually does add to society? Or really, if we look for evidence, does it show really what happens is people end up being in their own communities? We do it ourselves, let's not pretend otherwise. And we don't really see a fully integrated country.
Yes, and I agree, Greg, that, you know, total integration is difficult and we do tend to stay in our communities. And I was brought up in London, Irish parents, and we had a very Irish community. But there was also a lot of ethnic diversity as well. Mm. So all my neighbours were from, you know, different countries. And that, I think, changes your perspective. But yes, we do have our own, you know, cultural communities. But integration is a really important part of it. And I do think that some of the EU countries that have higher levels of immigration, for example, Germany Spain and France have greater levels of integration. There are always going to be incidents, of course.
No, of course, yeah, I understand that.
And be aware of that. But I think that we need to work towards increasing the integration and you know, enhancing cultural diversity and work away from the racism and start being critical of it.
Yes, of course. Mm. There is a sense, though, from people out there, that to increase diversity and inclusion, it's the largest population that seems to always have to make the concessions.
The largest.
I don't want to use white or Irish, yes. or mm-hmm. you know what I mean. So in other words, it seems to be, or people feel, and you can sort of counter this, feels that it's the indigenous population that has to cede all the ground.
Yes, and in some ways that is correct. And I have to say, I can see the challenges that people face. And I can see that if you're in a community that doesn't have a long history of cultural diversity, it can appear to be concerning. And for me, raising awareness is the key issue. And if we were to bring it into, for example, educational curriculum and start raising awareness. But yes, you're right. The people who are the indigenous population do have to make allowances. But we're complying, of course, with international law and human rights. We're all humans. And we need to start changing the perception, I think, that regardless of where we were born or where our family tradition is from, we are entitled to live and, you know, have accommodation and be employed. Mm. And also, I think we need to raise awareness about the real benefits of immigration in Ireland to the economy and to the workplace, yeah. In particular areas such as healthcare, as you know.
Tourism.
And tourism, mm. absolutely. Yeah. And I think that raising awareness, and yes, you're right, there are challenges for people, and I think we just have to get the balance right, mm-hmm. and acknowledge the challenges, but also raise awareness.
I'm old enough to remember waves of immigration. In the 90s, early 2000s, you know, places like Bundoran and other seaside towns, the population almost doubled with people coming from different countries and working. And I don't recall any anger or issue with that. Mm. I just wonder if we'd be having this conversation now, Siobhan, if we hadn't had years of, you know, I'm just going to use some of the phraseology that's out there, not that I subscribe to it, but, you know, busloads of men coming to areas that has no infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Or, for instance, areas like Letterkenny, for an example, where there's huge concentration of young fellas that have equal rights to try and escape, you know, persecution or whatever it might mm-hmm. be. And that really is sort of, I've found, change the attitudes more than anything, and the lack of communication, and the government actually doing away with, you know, negotiations or not negotiations, sorry, with information. They literally decided not to meet with local groups and just put these people who may well be fleeing the most worst situations. But that, I think that's driven an awful lot of where we're at right now.
It may well have done so. And I do think you're right. There has been a lack of information and a lack of engagement. And there should be more. And that's about that kind of raising awareness point. But I do think, and you make a good point about how in the past there wasn't that level of racism when immigrants arrived. I think social media has quite an influence in that regard. And it only takes one person, you know, for example, in a particular county to be making regular posts, which are misinformation often and disinformation, you know, which is fabricated. It may be in related to one particular crime and it's posted on social media and it influences the way people think.
Well, that actually frustrates me because, you know, I genuinely really care about society, particularly children and anyone who's vulnerable. And it's astonishing how many Indigenous people seem to get a pass for awful crimes whilst there's a massive focus on perhaps one person who might be responsible for crime. Like, I don't mind the anger, I don't mind the but share it out, you know?
Absolutely.
Share it out and let's protect children from everyone or whatever group in society it might be.
Yes.
But I do take your point. But it's interesting, if I was having this conversation with you 3 years ago, you know, some of the language being used by the likes of Minister Jim O'Callaghan, you probably would be condemning or calling far right, potentially. You know, his language has changed really quite significantly. Some, like, he advocates a firm, orderly and humane approach to immigration. He's made no apologies for wanting to reduce asylum claims. The government has admitted that there's a lot of people coming here simply just for the economics of it all. And so on and so forth. And he says people should be entitled to have this open debate about these issues. Many people agree with him. But my point being is that the language, as I say, that you might have described as far right or right leaning a couple of years ago is government policy now.
Yes, and it may well be that the minister is going down that particular pathway and using that language for, you know, political credence, knowing how the people are feeling. That may well be a factor. But yes, some of the recent statements, especially in relation to the new EU pact, I think are, you know, coming across as very robust and very almost giving the impression we're clamping down. And actually, I'm looking at the EU pact from a different perspective, that actually it's solidarity across the EU and it's, you know, a consistent and fair approach across, instead of each country having its own different process and policy. So yes, I think there are some concerns about the language used, and that of course is influencing people. And as you mentioned at the beginning, Greg, because I've worked in international protection, I now have great empathy for people who apply for international protection, who are here with their families, for example. And not all are successful, of course. In fact, the majority aren't. But to have lived in a country for X number of years and then have to leave because you've been refused international protection must be quite distressing. So I think that there needs to be more empathy in the language used and in the approach taken. That's not to say it's going to be granted to everybody, of course. We have to comply with the process. But I think we need to change the perception.
Yeah. What do you think needs to change to address people's concerns? Right, because I mean, I know you work in EDI. You're an EDI consultant, but again, it's you know, it seems to be the Indigenous that are looking to seed everything. So, what do you think the government needs to do to understand the concerns of people, to address those concerns, and to take their democratic views on board?
Well, that is a full day's work. That is a difficult one, I totally accept. I do think it's going to change in the long term because the ethnic diversity is growing in Ireland, and I think it will change people's perceptions. If you're at school now, you'll be much more used to ethnic diversity, and of course some schools are more diverse than others. And then when you're an adult, you'll have a slightly different perception. However, to answer your question, I think that the government needs to introduce training and raising awareness at education level and in, for example, in the workplace. And lots of community organisations are doing this, as you know.
Do we do anything? As you would know, people from different parts of the world have different beliefs, different rules, different cultures. Do we do anything at all to advise people coming here from a far-flung country that probably just simply don't know what life is like here? Do we do anything to educate them on what is culturally acceptable, unacceptable, what is right, what's wrong?
I think, you know, as a government, no, we don't. There are some organisations that, you know, refugee organisations that do some of that. However, the new EU migration pact that I know there is quite some criticism of, and I can see the pros and cons of it, but one of the things they are going to do in the new screening process is they are going to have some, as well as screening people, bring in some counselling and some support. And I think that cultural awareness will be or should be part of
that. Well, it has to be, doesn't it? Because a lot of these problems are, you know, it could be something like, you know, if I were from a particular country, women of a certain place in society, I can go up and say anything to them.
Yes.
Right? And I might come here and think, well, the same rules must apply here. But that causes a great deal of upset and anguish. It probably does in the home country, but also here. I'm just picking a random example for an example. And we aren't in any organised way trying to address that. And that, to me, is crazy.
We're not trying to address it. That is correct. And I think that's probably been a challenge for the government. And it might come coming back to the point you made earlier, where sometimes, you know, cultural groups are in silos and are, you know, not necessarily integrating in the community. That could be one of the reasons, actually. That's a good point, you know, the lack of cultural awareness. So I think you make a good point there. It's not just our cultural awareness in Ireland that needs to be broadened, but it's also the cultural awareness of new arrivals.
Yeah, that's what I was saying to you. Is it like it always feels like, you know, the Indigenous are seeding the you know what I mean? I mean, that would be illogical. And I've been saying this for years on this programme. I don't understand it. And because it doesn't give everyone a fair crack of the whip.
Yes, exactly. And we do have to get the balance right. And I know, for example, you know, if you give the example of the Irish emigrants over the years, and I know I bring that up a lot because I do think it's an important aspect of how we perceive this. And the Irish have moved, of course, to the UK and the United States and Australia more recently is rising in numbers. Are they trained in, you know, the cultural...
Well, have you been to Dubai?
I haven't.
Of course. Well... The Irish, the English go over there and religiously adhere to the local rules and regs in terms of wearing a bikini or a short skirt in public or, you know...
Because it's mandatory, yes.
Well, it's also mandatory, but there's an awareness of it.
Yes, that's a good point, yes.
Yeah, so there's already proof of that.
I think it's a really good point that should be brought in. So when we talk about the potential changes that could be made to raise awareness and to change the misconceptions, it's not just about the Irish people. It's also about having to raise awareness for the people who are arriving in Ireland and being aware of the Irish culture. So I think the government should bring that in as part of the international protection process. In fact, I think that's a good point.
Siobhan, you are obviously working in the area that working in and working hard on equality and all that type of stuff. And your heart's genuinely, obviously, very clearly in the right place. And that's based off your experience and knowing people and understanding them. But if the truth be told, I don't see a political party out there that's kind of really, you know, pushing what you're talking of effectively, you know what I mean? And there seems to be a pushback politically and there seems to be a pushback from whether they're a minority, they're a very noisy minority in terms of immigration and the EU pact. Do you think you're fighting a losing battle? You know, particularly in the context of, I mean, you can see what the Americans say about Europe's immigration policy, for an example. This is Europe-wide and we're seeing other countries take. So my point is are we ever really going to see the future that you might like to see where there is, you know, mass integration and everything's rosy in the garden? Because I don't really see that. There's a tide turning. I don't know if it can be held back.
I think politically, perhaps that's not going to happen rapidly. Absolutely. I may have to start a new political party for that to happen. I think politically, perhaps not. But of course, politicians, they have to generally align especially the PR side of it, to what the people are wanting and believing, because they want to be elected. I am surprised, I have to say, Greg, that some parties are not being more supportive. Those that are perhaps, to use the term, more left-wing parties that are not being more supportive. But I genuinely believe it is going to change, because I do think the Irish culture is going to change, because there will be people who are Irish people who are not necessarily white and don't have a long history of the Irish culture. But in 10, 15, 20 years, Irish people will be more diverse. So I think it's going to change. I'm not saying it's going to take that long, but I think the importance should be to raise awareness.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not sure I agree with you, but that doesn't mean you're wrong and it doesn't mean I'm right either. It's not necessarily what I believe should happen. It's what I believe will happen, if you know what I mean. Tracking the way things are moving all over the place. Listen, it's been a very interesting conversation, Siobhan, and it's good to have a different perspective on all these conversations. And I don't think yours is radical. There's lots of people who agree with you. Just not a lot of people want to say it out loud.
Absolutely. And I think people are worried to say it out loud because the general conception out there is perhaps the opposite. And social media now has become a way of criticising people. But I'm happy to say it out loud because you're right, there are lots of people with similar beliefs are a little bit behind the curtain. So let's come out and say it more would be my thoughts.
Yeah, all right. Listen, lovely having you in. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Greg.
A lot of you messaging in on that last topic, as you can imagine. Can we talk about the cultural differences in small communities? Some cultures don't appreciate women or like how we dress. How will these cultural differences affect our rural communities? A question I did put to Siobhan as well. More women in public life would mean more diversity. Why are diversity officers always foreigners, which is patronising? Don't conflate historic emigration from Ireland with immigrants coming to Ireland, as they're being brought here to replace Irish workers who emigrated because of poor wages and bad working conditions. Some of that's true. If you look deep dive into the figures, some of it isn't true as well. There's a lot of the jobs that immigrants are coming in here to do that you can't actually get Irish people to do. And that's a fact. And I know because I've spoken to people in the industry, but a lot of what you say there is true also. It's one of the biggest issues is the lack of mixing. The individual communities tend to keep themselves to themselves, says the listener. Therefore, there's a lack of understanding of their traditions. You see it all the time. One type of community moves into an estate, and as soon as another house becomes available, the same community buys it, often leading to a high volume of them in one place. We do that too. When we go away. But where we go, generally, with the exception of maybe the UAE, there's not a huge cultural variance. So if we go to America, very similar culture. We go to Australia, very similar culture. And I did ask Siobhan straight out, give me an example of where, society has fully integrated. So I made your point to Siobhan as well. Greg, where does that woman come from? Irish people went away and had to work hard, didn't get anything for nothing, but these illegal immigrants who come here get well looked after. Irish people, says the listener, are paying for all of these immigrants. Europe as a whole is, but I take your point. She's continuously conflating immigrants with asylum seekers. It has nothing to do with the Migration Pact. 80% of PPSN numbers issued to asylum seekers over the past 10 years have never worked, according to Department of Social Protection stats. The Migration Pact means asylum seekers must be provided with accommodation on arrival. This is while 17,000 people are long-term homeless. I'll just point out many of those 17,000 people are non-Irish, if the truth be told. The Migration Pact is a law we've unnecessarily opted into, so it's not complying with international law. Another, morning, Greg. Too many migrants coming into this country. We do not have enough houses, school places, doctor's appointments, etc. Bring our Irish doctors and nurses home, pay and give them decent conditions. Our young people all leaving because of government policy. Let the Irish people have a referendum on immigration. Thank you. Another, your lady speaker says, and I quote, people are looking at it negatively in relation to different cultures coming in. That's ignorant. The Irish love all cultures, but it's the lack of respect by a government throwing them in without assessing needs to healthcare and education. And on top of that, taxing the hard worker and paying those that don't work or don't want to quite well in terms of social welfare payments for themselves and their families in whatever land that may be. That's what makes that comment ignorant and more coming in. And I think it's really important, and we always want to be a space on this programme, certainly, where we can talk about these issues In a way, you will find it difficult to hear on other radio stations where all different views are there. We might not agree, but we don't, and listeners haven't descended into, you know, really dramatic comments. Let's have this. This is coming. We have to talk about it. Coming up after 7 o'clock this evening, it's this week's DL Debate, the GEA Sportscast, sports podcast from Highland Radio, with its presenter, Brendan Devaney, who's with me now. How are you getting on, Brendan?
Good, G-Man, how are you?
Good to see you, my friend. Right, okay, so I presume Donegal v Cork, that's going to be the big chat tonight, amongst other things.
Yeah, indeed. Listen, we have some unbelievable games coming up, Greg. I suppose for us, the trip to Cork is number... trip of Cork coming to us is number one, but you know, obviously the B games and the B pool, they're the real jeopardy games. So you've your championship on the line for eight counties there. But for us, Greg, yeah, big game, Cork coming up, and a very dangerous Cork team for me. You know, they're a brilliant performance, brilliant one against Meath the last day, even though they lost their captain after 57 minutes. And he'll obviously got a red card. That'll be a big loss for them. But they're a big physical, power-running team, Greg, and they're a dangerous opposition for us.
Yeah, and they're coming up, obviously, to the Lions Den, but it's a big new pitch for everyone.
That's it. So much talk about this pitch, Greg, and there was when Jarvis Burns announced that it was going to be played in Balbuffet, no one in Donegal seemed to know that information. So we kind of dropped that, put that out there. But yeah, this thing, like, there's been a lot of talk about the pitch being ready, and is it ready for this match, and it's not. But listen, obviously it is, and the game is going to be played, and we look forward to going back to Balbuffet, because as you said, we have an unbelievable record there, like only two defeats in 20 years.
Hopefully we don't see it cutting up and slipping. I hope it is ready, because you do sometimes see that on newly laid pitches, but hopefully we won't in this case. I put it to Oisin last week. He says not a chance, but you know, there would have been a familiarity with that pitch for the Donegal squad. That's not a factor, is it? It's just grass. It's just grass, isn't it?
It would have been a thing, like, yeah, well, you haven't played on it this season, so it's not really a familiarity. You just prefer to have a few games on it, yeah. But I think everybody knows the ground that well. They'd be feel very comfortable. They obviously do a few training sessions on it as well, which will test the pitch in its own manner. Now, I'm sure they'll be lighting up, because the McCool Park crew won't want anything too heavy on there, but it will give them a bit of a feel for it, because there will be, with a new pitch, Greg, a certain amount of give, a certain bounce of the ball, not that you will want to get used to before the big game.
How will the game go? I kind of feel Cork are coming up with almost nothing to lose, or everything to lose, you could say it like that. You know, there's a lot of pressure on Donegal. You know, we've had our lows and we've had our highs. It's very hard to know how it will go. My feeling is that Donegal will blow them away, but that could be stupid.
Good man, Craig. Listen, Greg, if Donegal played their best, they won the game. Now, you look how focused we were in Kerry, our efficiency in front of goals, how well we play, how well we approached the match. It was back to the real Donegal after the slip against Down. So it's a matter of just of our guys being on it and being at their best. And we've been lucky, obviously, with injuries. There was a lot of injury talk going into the game. All that there dissipated when we seen the starting team. I'd never any doubt we actually would beat that Kerry team, sending off or not, once I seen our starting 15, because it was top class. So I think that's the big thing for us. It's just our own performance levels at home. You'd be relying on Cork trying to upset that in some way for the game to tip in their balance. But they are a good side. They're a dangerous team, no doubting. But if we played our best, we'll beat them.
And when you look through the fixtures list for next week, I mean, there's great games everywhere, isn't there? There's pretty much all of the games you'd love to watch. Mayo versus Tyrone's a cracker.
Yeah,
huge game. Louth Armagh. The stories behind pretty much all of the games, Cavan Dublin,
The only thing, as I say, Greg, with those games is that you'll still get into a pre-quarter final if you're beaten. So there's a lot in line, because you just want to be in the quarter final. Plus, even for your own confidence, if you want to go further in the competition, you want to be beating the team that you're playing to know that you can take a team out in Croke Park. But certainly it's the B games there. You know, if you look at the phenomenal season Roscommon have had, Connacht champions, like they lose narrowly to Tyrone by a point last day, they're away to Monaghan. Like, that's a sticky one. I mean,
great game though.
So they're massive games. You think Kerry will probably beat Kildare. Derry Meath again, it's all on the line.
Cracker,
yeah. Meath this year, how can Derry cope with them? So, yeah, some fascinating tussles in there, and can Cavan put up the Dubs? Great time for Cavan to be hosting the Dubs as well. So, yeah, some great ties in there, and the new format of the Championship has really put great energy into the All-Ireland Series.
A lot to talk about tonight. You've got some great guests, as always. You have them every week. We're kind of spoilt at this stage. Pat McBrearty is going to be on the show. Cork GAA writer Dennis Herney. And I'm always really interested in sort of the away team's perspective on this. Cork's a million miles from here. What are they thinking? You know, maybe their eyes are on hurling, I don't know, but it's going to be really interesting to see what Dennis has to say about how he thinks his team will fare and the attitude coming up here. And Niamh Connell's John Gilday on as well. So a great mix there, Brendan.
Yeah, and listen, as you said, Greg, I do different podcasts and I'll be ringing people all over the country, because particularly when you're that far away, to get a grasp of where Cork are at in terms of the mindset, the team, any potential injuries or who's informing that, you need to find that. So Dennis will bring that. And again, first time Patrick McBrearty to be on the show. Obviously, he's been doing stuff with GAA Go. So it'll be great to get his insight on what he's seen of his teammates this year, and I suppose how he's getting on in his new role in the media.
Everyone seems to be on GEA Go. The other people not standing there at one point was me, you and Caroline. I mean, no wonder it's 95 quid a season. They had about eight people standing, giving their opinion.
So that's, I was joking with Aaron Kieran about this last week, because obviously the cameras are at McCool Park, but they're not streaming it. So I was like, listen, could you just divert 5 or 6 of them people, maybe send them different places?
Look, I've even got the white runners, look.
The white runners, yeah, you're trendy, Greg. I know you'll never be lacking.
I'm waiting for the call up. Listen, Brendan, looking forward to the show tonight. Look after yourself. Thanks very much indeed. That's Brendan Devaney there, DL Debate, just after 7 o'clock tonight.
Where your opinion matters. The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Now, I'm joined in studio by Laura Byrne, who's Elevate 55 project worker with the Donegal Youth Service. Good to have you back in studio. How are you?
I'm good, Greg. How are you?
Excellent. Now, it's well established now at this stage, but for those who are a little bit behind the curve, Elevate 55 was formerly the Loft Summer Programme, but I've done Elevate 55. It's been around for a bit, hasn't it?
We've been around for a little while. It was just a little rebrand, but we're still, in principle, the same.
Right, and you know, this is fantastic for people in and around Letterkenny, because there are parts of this county that simply don't have these resources and we're crying out for them. So, you know, it's fantastic that they're there. So are we talking particularly about, you know, what younger people can do during the summer, you know, school's out, all that kind of stuff?
Exactly. We've got a lot of young people that now have got a lot of time on their hands mm-hmm. during the summer holidays, and absolutely well earned to have a little rest. But we know that keeping people busy is good. So we've got a really full programme and really varied activities to offer young people from the ages of 8 to around about 18, starting at the end of June and running all the way through to August.
And it's broad, isn't it? I mean, it might be a game of pool. It could be maybe, you know, exploring your artistic side. There's a lot going on for younger people with various interests.
Yeah, really, really broad. So on a daily basis, we have the drop-in, which is based in Letterkenny. We're on the Port Road, 16 to 18 Port Road, and we're on the top floor above Donegal ETB. Mm-hmm. Most people say, oh, opposite the old grill? Yeah, that's exactly where we are. Okay. So we are on the top floor there, and we have drop-in that runs there Monday to Thursday from 12 o'clock till 6, Friday 12 till 9, and Saturday 2 till 6,
Super.
With the only service that runs 6 days a week.
And what kind of stuff is on site then for
so
kids dropping in?
On site in the drop-in, you can just call in from the ages of 12 to 18. And we've got pool, we have table tennis, we have a range of different gaming consoles, we have chess, we've got art resources, we have a fully kitted out band room. So we've got access to instruments, and we've just put in a brand new drum kit as well, which we're very excited about. We've got recording equipment for any young people that are interested in looking into a bit of music production. So a whole range of things there. And we also have really comfy sofas, mm-hmm. free Wi-Fi, tea, coffee, snacks.
Now, that's what's there on tap. But
on
also
tap.
There's a series of programmes being run too, or specific interest stuff. So talk to me about that. Has that began already? Or
so we have a weekly programme that we run throughout the year.
Brilliant.
And that's an evening-based programme. And actually, in the summer, we know that we maybe like our lions after we've had a busy time at school.
I'll be interested to see what time it starts up. We talk about lions.
So our evening programmes kind of start from between 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock.
Good, yeah.
And we run those 6 nights a week. So on a Monday, we have our group, which is a social group for young people with autism. Mm-hmm. That runs from 6 o'clock till 8 o'clock. And we also have a girls' wellness group, and they meet from 5 o'clock till six also. And the girls' group is really exploring what the girls want to have a look at. It could be baking, it could be health and beauty, it could be sport, it could be anything really. It's tailored by the girls themselves and what they're interested in. Tuesday, we've got basketball at the Aura from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock. It's very competitive. Mm-hmm. And then we also have our creative nights. So our junior groups, we're talking ages 8 to 11. They come in and they take part in all different types of arts and crafts. And then from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, it's a little bit more chilled out. It's for our ages 12 to 18 to explore things like digital drawing, animation, music, media, sketching. It's a really, really nice evening. Wednesdays, we've got football, again, out of the Aura from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock. That's for ages 14 plus. And then a group called Worldwide Voices, which is a group to bring young people together from all over the world. We have a big world map in the youth service where young people have been mapping out where they're from. And the diversity of the young people that come into the service is phenomenal. So from 6 o'clock till 8 o'clock, well, we've got Worldwide Voices. And on Thursday, 6 till 8, we have gaming night. So we know and we hear from parents a lot about the concern regarding gaming and isolation. So we put gaming into a social platform, get everybody together. We've got that tea, we've got that coffee, we've got that social element, but there's young people gaming with each other on all different types of consoles as well. We've got some retro consoles
in there.
I
understand parents' concerns and they're very accurate. And of course, they're on about in-person stuff. But gaming online is incredibly social.
Of course.
Like I don't have as much time as I used to, but you're literally playing with people all over the world, making friends with people all over the world. And whilst the person might be in their own space on their own, you can't underestimate their friend circle. It's huge. Like, but exactly. I know parents want face-to-face stuff.
It's that, and it's also the supervision. So, yes, gaming online is fantastic. And I agree with you. And I think that there's so much that young people can reach through that way. Mm. But there is also that concern around supervision. And that's where bringing it into that social platform, just one evening a week out of seven.
And it maybe can bring you out of the home space as well. That's so there's your gaming opportunity
and
there.
Mean the young people that have got a shared interest. Sometimes young people feel like, I'm the only person that's interested in Dungeons and Dragons. I'm the only person that's interested in Zelda. And then actually they come and they might come along to game in night and they meet somebody else that also has
There's always someone with the same interest.
Yeah.
Let's talk to parents and guardians of children that they want to see, young people that they want to see get involved, but they might be a little bit shy or they might be hard to encourage. They know they'd grow from it and make new friends. It'd be fantastic for them, but they can't get them in through the door per se. Now, I don't mean kicking and screaming. I mean, you know, with the appropriate, you know, you don't want anyone doing something they don't want to do, but you know they'd like to do it, but they're a little bit socially nervous or something, right? Because I want those young people to get in there and grow as well, right?
We want that too, yeah.
Is in terms of an induction or how you might work with a parent or guardian, is there anything in there to sort of encourage those young ones across the door?
Absolutely. We're really person-centred. And the most important thing that we say to parents is lift the phone and get the ball rolling with us. Mm. And the thing that we really focus on is meeting the young person where they're at. So some introductions with young people, it can start with sending them videos and pictures of our space so that they have some kind of familiarity of what the place looks like, where it is. How do I get there? What button do I have to press if I need to buzz at the door, if the door is locked over, because we have a little magnet on the door at times. So it's looking at where the young person is at and what will help them break down that first barrier. We go out and we do house visits for young people to give an introduction into our service for them to, you know, if they're not ready to come out the house, then we'll go to them. We'll have a little introduction, have a conversation.
Like, and perhaps in the majority of cases, it is just a little bit of social anxiety. You know, I mean, obviously there can be other things underlying, but sometimes it's that boy or girl that they're just a wee bit shy.
Yeah.
So it's lovely that
And
you
our
have
role
that.
There as the youth workers and staff that are there is to be that familiar face. Mm. And if we have to take that familiar face out of our service first to meet that young person to then have to bring them in.
But history shows that you see the person evolve as soon as they actually do get in there and become the...
Yeah.
And, you know, you've went through some of the programmes there. July and August, lots of stuff coming on. You mentioned photography and film storytelling in August, art, music, pop-up events, etc., etc. Now, for the drop-in side of things, I presume it's drop-in, it's casual, right?
Drop-in is really casual. You can just turn up. For the groups in the evening...
You don't want to oversubscribe them either, right? So where can people get a list of them? Maybe talk to the young people whilst they're off school and maybe book them a place.
Absolutely. So on our, we're on social media, on Facebook and on Instagram. And our website has a really good overview because we've just been talking about what we've got going on in Letterkenny, but we've actually got links all over the county. So really highly recommend checking out our website as well. And then a phone call into the office, and that call will be directed to the right person who's working on the right project for helping to get a young person linked in. But as you said, drop-in is just, as it says, dropping in. Our evening groups, we keep them a little bit smaller, again, like you said, to help with that social anxiety. So just a call beforehand to express some interest and we can go from there. And then for our summer schedule that we've got running, as you said, all through the summer, there's actually a booking form to book places onto. And again, just calling into the office, a phone call on 074 912 9630 or contacting us via social media and we'll send you a link on to the booking forms. And as you said, you can book on there.
And naturally, some of those events require there to be a nominal cost, I think, personally speaking, but also to ensure that it can be as inclusive as possible. There are some funded places where it's the most applicable.
Absolutely. And again, that just comes from having that initial conversation with one of our team and we can look at how we're best able to support. We don't want any barriers in place for young people and we know that it's difficult enough at the moment. So yeah, anybody please reach out.
Yeah, and this is a number whereby the person answering it genuinely wants to work with you and help you and include the young people in your life. 074 912 9630. Is that the catch-all number?
Yeah.
Right, so for anything we've talked about, even about teasing out, you know, a drop-in visit or talking about some of these particular interest events, it's a busy, busy summer.
It is going to be a really busy summer, Greg.
Right, yeah. Well, best wishes with it.
Thanks
so
much.
Great fun.
Thank you.
The Loft, Elevate 55, formerly the Loft Summer Programme. There's something there for everybody. And we've just been speaking to Laura Byrne, Elevate 55 project worker. There's lots of activities in Letterkenny, 16 to 18 Port Road. Lots of stuff happening elsewhere as well. Best thing you can do is check out their socials, the website, and give them a call, 074 912 9630. And as you heard there, you know, if you have a young one that just needs a little bit of extra encouragement or reassurance, they're on the end of the phone there to help as well. Connor Dowling is Director of Advocacy at the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And he's talking to us this morning about a campaign to see a ban on sulky horse racing. Good morning to you, Connor. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Greg.
So for anyone listening who may not be aware, what is sulky horse racing?
Well, a sulky is a horse-drawn vehicle that's designed for harness racing on the track. It's something that's been developed over years to be as fast as possible, as aerodynamic as possible, and really not suited to the public road. So these vehicles are towed by one of two types of horses, trotters or pacers, depending on their gait. So our argument is that while this activity may be acceptable on the track where it's controlled and it's safer, it's just not suited to the public road. So we have a petition that we're calling on the public to sign on at insight.ie to support our call for a prohibition on the use of these particular vehicles, horse-drawn vehicles, and the use of sulky horses on the public road.
So you're telling me that it's currently legal to head up the four lanes out of Letterkenny. It's perfectly legal at the moment to fly up there in your sulky horse and cart.
Well, we see in sort of different types of activity. We've all been familiar with the races you see on the videos where the roads are blocked off. And obviously there's illegal activity going on there from a road traffic point of view. But, you know, even if you're training a horse for those races and using a horse at, you know, at speeds approaching 50 kilometers an hour on a hard surface, running it like that is inherently damaging to the animal, and it's a problem from its health, from its health and welfare. But you know, there's also a road safety and a public safety element to this as well. We've seen incidents where these horses have collided with vehicles. We've seen a number of incidents, and some of them have had tragic consequences for the horses involved.
And you see them just the horse collapsed on the ground, still attached to the cart it's towing.
Yeah, obviously, you know, if on a hard surface like that, if there is an incident and a horse falls, the potential for damage is much higher than if it's on a soft surface. But we also feel that it's only a matter of time before there's a human tragedy. Because, you know, we've seen near misses already.
Is sulky horse racing particularly associated with any particular cultures?
Well, some people would say it's a tradition of the traveller community, but it's not confined exclusively to the traveller community at all. There are a lot of settled people involved with it as well. Perhaps travellers are more likely to be involved. But again, it's not something that has been going on for, you know, an extensive period of time in terms of hundreds of years. Though, of course, there has been competition between horse-drawn vehicles, races, for a long time. But when you look at the sulkies that we see now, the modern ones, they're unrecognisable from the vehicles that were used, you know, 70, 80 years ago even. And you can watch videos on YouTube of how they've evolved for the racing on the track. And they've been streamlined and just, of course, with new materials now, new metals, which are more lightweight, they can just go faster and faster.
So in the first instance, Conor, I mean, we have an old saying up here around the Donegal Rally, keep the race in its place. Is that part of this effectively that you're not looking for sulky horse racing to be outlawed altogether? You know, do it on an appropriate surfaces in appropriate places?
Yeah, harness racing is hugely popular in other countries. In Sweden, for example, it's much more popular than regular horse racing. So there is the potential for that activity to be done on the tracks. So, you know, that's what we need to do is move it away from the public roads where it's causing more of a danger to the horses than needs and to the public. I get onto the tracks.
All right, stay there. Hugh Friel is a member of the traveller community and he's called in. Hugh, thanks for joining us. You've been involved for a number of years with sulky racing. Would you be in favour of it being banned from the public highways? You know, as I said to Conor there, keep the race in its place, you know, on grass or more appropriate surfaces. Or are you happy with the status quo?
I think, you know, Greg, that a lot of people look at the sulky racing and think as they assume straight away that it's members of the traveller community, which is inaccurate. The second thing that I want to say to you is that over 80% of the sulky racing done is done by settled people because I'm heavily involved in the sulky racing. And, you know, a lot of people who I would be in contact with is settled people who race the horses. And I think, you know, there's a very few that gives us a bad name in relation to doing that. And I even get sickened myself looking at the, you know, a horse collapsing there in Limerick and stuff like that, and the horse welfare and around care and its consideration, but also care and consideration for the public as well.
Yep.
And
just to be
you know,
absolutely,
collaboration and,
Hugh, before we tease it out more, just to be absolutely clear, no one was casting any dispersions on the traveller community or speaking out in that regard, neither I nor Conor.
Just
to be absolutely clear.
Yeah, no, but I wanted to give the public a kind of a view of it because we are associated with sulky racing.
Yeah,
and
you.
Sometimes, you know, the public would view that as members, all the members of the traveller community, which I'm kind of highlighting is not. The people who I'm involved with and been involved with for 30 years is from the settled community.
Okay, we'll move past that then. We'll move past that. Let's talk about the horse welfare. You know, it's not appropriate on you know, finished surfaces, hard roads, in terms of the welfare of the horse, the danger if one were to come off, and you know, vehicular traffic on those roads. You can't be surely in favour, Hugh, of allowing roads to be closed off for races or not closed off for races on public roads. You can't be in favour of that, surely.
No, I'm not in favour of that, but I do think like there's a history and there's a legacy of the horse and the sulky and the racing on the road, and we've been doing it for, like, if you look at West Cork, for instance, Craig, and I think people doesn't know kind of the history of the sulky racing in Ireland. And like you look at West Cork, it's an old tradition. It's run for over 150 years in West Cork, where the council, the local authorities now closed the road down. They closed Bandon, if you know Bandon town. They closed the road, got out of Bandon for the Martin's racing, for the there's a committee set up and all that there. So I think that if it was done appropriately and done efficiently, there'd be better I suppose negotiation with the local authority and to make it kind of more appropriate. And like we've raised like hundreds of thousands to charities over the years as well, like the local hospice here in Letterkenny. We've given money to Crumlin Hospital, like I mean maybe 100,000 or something, 80,000-90,000 to Crumlin Hospital in Dublin. Like the Ringsend Trotting Club in Ringsend as well, they've raised over 140,000 over the last 20 something years and given to various different charities. So I think we've you know, and the other side of that coin is that we're very charitable. No doubt about that.
No one's saying it's bad people involved in it. It's whether the practice is suitable for 2026 and for the animals involved. But I take your point. But no one's saying these are bad people. It's just the debate is whether or not it should.
Sometimes, Greg, the community that I've involved with. You know, people paint a bad picture in relation to what's going on in it. Mm. And I think, you know, if you look at Sulky Race in Ireland, the documentary, the horses, even the veterinary and Liz Dell now was saying, but them horses is looked after to precision condition. And even my own horse, my grandson has a wee horse. Like, and it's more about that as well, about, you know, one's mental health as well. And it's in your blood. It's something you can't help. You just can't pick it up off the ground.
Stay,
it's something that you can't help either. So
stay there, Hugh. Connor, Hugh makes a compelling argument there.
Well, just to say a couple of areas, you know, I agree with Hugh and I already said, you know, this is not an activity that's confined exclusively to one community. So don't it to be portrayed or interpreted that it's directed at a particular community. It's a practice itself. You know, the traffic around the horse obviously is a huge problem if it's conducted on an open public road. But even on at a closed road, the hard surfaces mean that the pounding of the hooves on that surface do cause damage to the animal's joints, and they will cause problems. So even though, as Hugh says, I mean, the horses that are winning these races can be in extremely good physical condition. You know, they're prime athletes, animal athletes, if you like. But it's going to be relatively short because that continuous pounding on that hard surface is going to cause damage to the joints and ultimately affect the well-being of the animal.
Yeah, but I mean, you see, and never the twain will meet on this because, I mean, Connor makes a good logical argument there that's based in science, but Hugh, you're going to say, aren't you, that these animals get the absolute best of care. And you know, this is where we're going to be.
I don't agree with that. I don't actually agree with what Connor said there, because in relation to that, horses are physical. The pacing horses and the trotting horses are built for the ability of that. And like, I have a horse there at 11 year old. I've raced horses up to 14 years of age that have been racing on the roads for 4 to 5 years and are now in riding schools. And I think that, you know, we sometimes compare that to saying that the horse gets damaged. You know, if a horse has an issue, any of my horses, they go to the vet straight away. Mm. And, you know, a lot of the horses will be bandaged, they'll be well looked after, they'll be rubbers under the feet.
You talked about sort of where there's more prevalence of sulky horse racing. Are there any scheduled meets in Donegal, Hugh, and if so, where did they take place?
We do, they do, more of a beach there, you know, in the morning time and stuff like that. So a lot of beach racing and stuff like that there. Mm-hmm. But like, there's a lot of physical work to put onto horse racing. Like,
is there any road racing done in Donegal, Hugh, and if so, where?
No.
There's none, right, okay.
No, we don't. We're more now to the Mayor's Harness Racing with the tracks now in Belfast at Annaghmore, and there's one previously been built in Cork. So a lot of people are going to the tracks now at the minute, are converting from the road to the
tracks. And those tracks, are they sand or grass or what?
They're hard gravel. Like they're more, like they're prevalent. They can cause more damage to a horse on the professional racing. Connor's mentioned Sweden there in France, America. The tracks there is really, really hard surfaced. Okay. You know, and they inflict more danger to the horse and more welfare to the horse than any surface, because they're going around a corner. They've been, you know, there's different various things that happens. Horses' backs and tendons and ligaments and, you know, these, because they run basically around a corner for most of the race.
Of course, in an oval.
But then it's under professional contact, and their vets and their ambulances there, and it's safe. That's something it's safe.
Right, Hugh. Listen, thanks for your input. I appreciate it. Thankfully, we live in a democracy, and Hugh can have his opinion, and so can our friend Connor here. And I suppose it's up to the public. You either say, right, I have concern for the animal's safety, I can go to uplift.ie or choose not to. I used to have an interest, not an interest in horse racing, but used to follow, but dog racing, horse racing, sulky racing, I've kind of gone off it a little bit, the whole idea of us getting on these big, beautiful animals and running them around for our pleasure. But that's just one point of view. So, you know, I mean, obviously people might agree with you, Connor. People might agree with you. It's up to them. Go to the NSPCA, presumably, to get the uplift link.
Yeah, if you go down to our NSPCA.ie, our website, you should be able to find it there, uplift.ie.
Okay. And when you hear there this idea that the gravel tracks are being built now in 2026, I'm sure you're aware of that. That's not ideal either in the context of what we're talking about. I'm sure the ISPCA would feel.
Well, I mean, I was researching some statistics on horse racing injuries, and statistically it seems that harness racing horses are far less likely to be injured than in traditional horse racing, even in flat horse racing. So, you know, if you have it on the track, it's a lot safer than on a public road, for sure.
Listen, thank you very much for your time, Connor. And just to be absolutely clear, if it wasn't already, neither I or Connor were talking about any particular group or culture. It was a broad conversation. But I also understand that Hugh wanted an opportunity to dispel what public myths might be out there. So we all know where we're at. Thanks so much, Connor. Really appreciate your time. Bye-bye. That's Connor Dowling, Director of Advocacy at the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. What do you think? 08660 25000. Now, very busy on the text line as always, which never goes underappreciated. A caller says, last year, Micheál Martin himself stated that over 50% of those here claiming international protection. Yet your guest ignores the elephant in the room by talking about legal immigration on par with legal. No, what Siobhan was saying, and it is facts, because I have read these stats out before, the overwhelming majority of people coming into this country are coming in on visas and to work. There is not an insignificant number, but it is the smaller number of those that are coming in here for asylum. So the two things can coexist as well. But that number coming in from asylum can still be discussed as whether it's too big or too little, or one area is getting too many people and another isn't, or whether the services are there for them, or if they aren't, or how they're being housed, or where they're being housed. So what Siobhan is saying is factual, but I think a lot of people know this. The overwhelming majority of people coming into Ireland are coming in legally, be it the free movement within Europe or on work visas, etc. Greg, why was the European Pact put on the people? Should this not be up to the people to make this choice? Caroline, I would love to do a piece on the European Migration Pact, if that's okay, just so we can get all of the facts out there, what it might mean to Ireland, what it might not mean to Ireland. So we'll do that this week, actually, just to get everything out there, even for my own benefit, so I have a better understanding of it. A lot of the issues for us as women is we see these women in burqas and immediately feel they're undervalued in their society. Ireland is fighting to give an equal voice to women in Ireland, and this attitude is setting us back to the Stone Age. Yeah, I get where you're coming from. I'm not a woman. But if those women are willfully doing so because that's the culture and the religion that they follow, part of women's rights would it be not that they should be able to exercise themselves as they see fit, or not exercise themselves, dress themselves as they see fit? I don't know. I think maybe, Greg, a full explanation of what immigrants are receiving from social welfare is needed. Perhaps it would give a better understanding and stop the spreading of myths. Do they get free medical care, accommodation, hairstyles, cars, education, etc.? And do Irish citizens get the same? The issue is there is so much out there about what they are getting, whilst Irish citizens are struggling to get anything. People in international protection don't get much at all. That's actually the truth. People coming here, for instance, Ukrainian people, there's a lot of advantages there. Not everything that you talked of, but certainly there's a lot of advantage that gives them an advantage in an open rental market, for an example. But in terms of people in IPASS, the amount of money they receive is not what you might think. It's quite low. Fair play, Greg. That's exactly it. If the Irish go abroad, we have to live by the rules, and the same should apply the other way. And I don't think that's controversial. I think sometimes, and what I've tried to talk about too, as well, even about coming here as a financial, if you're coming here, what's the terminology? If you're coming here just for the money or whatever, like that's the terms and conditions. Like if my children had to leave here, I would look around the place and I'd go, right, where are you going to get the best stuff? Where are you going to get the best money, the best accommodation, the best health service? And you would say, go there, get there quick. You know, if you had to. So that's going to happen. If you have a system set up in a certain way, it's set up. You set it up. People aren't arriving and making that system. You've made that system. And it's just not really talked about often like that when I believe it should. Hi, Greg. Very disappointed to hear the bad reviews Letterkenny got regarding litter. We've got 7 litter wardens, but why have they no signs on their vans and jeeps like other counties? I think visibility is a big thing. Management in Donegal County Council would need to address the issue. I will say about those litter surveys, I've never been a massive fan of them. It depends when they visit. You know, there can be very unique reasons as to why an area is littered. It doesn't mean that Letterkenny now all of a sudden is some sort of a dump and the council has dropped the ball. They can come at certain days. There could be a development. There could be signage that's up. There could be, you know, it can be very in the moment and is not always very reflective. Now, that's easy to say. If you were top of the list, you'd be putting up posters saying we're the best, and you kind of mitigate when you're down the list. But I don't read too much into that. Have you really noticed Letterkenny getting dirty in the last year? I don't think so. Are there little hot spots here and there from time to time? Of course there are. Those surveys are for guidance. And the reason no other town, Buncrana, might get the odd litter survey, but nowhere else does, you know, so they pick certain areas. Greg, does anybody know when the pride flags in Letterkenny have been taken down? Surely it'd be done by now. The parade is over. They are an eyesore. Okay. Are they? I don't know. I haven't seen them. I haven't been in Letterkenny. Let me see. Morning, Greg. Happy Monday. I was wondering, did you see the viral video doing the rounds of the Dublin Rose giving a speech in Islam or on Islam and the takeover of Christian Ireland? Would appreciate your thoughts. Thank you. I didn't see it at all. No, I don't mind having a look, though. I shall have a look and get back to you. I don't think anyone should be talking about taking over anywhere, regardless, you know, we all have to live together. Let me see. I didn't pay this request for a very important person. In fact, it's a fabulous daddy. Roy Mooney is from Burt, and he's celebrating his 93rd birthday today. Apparently, he's some man for one man. So, Roy, hopefully you're listening. Roy Mooney in Burt. I hope you have a wonderful birthday. Happy birthday to you. Lots of love from us all here on The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio, but especially from Adele, Stephen, Gavin and Laura, who I'd say are very close to you. Two very special guests in the studio with me now. I've got Isabel, chairperson of the Donegal Hospice. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back in. Still not getting used to it, but we will get a handle on this. Jamie Sweeney is with us as well. Hi, Jamie.
Morning, Greg. Morning, listeners.
Great to have you with us. I want to speak to you in a moment, Jamie, but first I want to talk to you, Isabel, about this amazing sum of money that has been raised. I saw a picture of you and David with this astronomical 6 figures.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as everybody knows, we started the J for June during COVID because we couldn't do any other fundraisers. We couldn't do our Churchgate collection or coffee mornings or at Sunflower Day or anything like that. So I opened my mouth at a meeting and said, well, I think I would like to run a J for June. And it just took off from there. So for 2025 was 626,000. And then from it started, I'm up at 2,006,000.
It's remarkable, isn't
it? Yeah. But without Highland Radio and everybody doing the fundraisers, like, it's not about dancing, Greg. They're doing everything. We run it from January to December. And
The Jive for June's the hook, but
yeah,
this is
that's
an
a platform.
Annual drive,
yeah, that's
it?
A platform. Yeah. So, people do everything. They have cake sales, they run dances, and they do everything. Mm-hmm. So in January, I would write out probably over about 350 letters to men's sheds, football clubs, golf clubs, everything. all the schools.
We haven't gone away, you know.
No, we haven't. But I did say at the start I would do it for 1 year, but it seems to have taken legs.
But it's hard to, I mean, the way it's growing and moving forward, it's hard to, I mean, it's an amazing initiative. And the reason why, Isabel, you know as well as anyone does, is because of it's the Donegal Hospice. And anyone who has had dealings with the Donegal Hospice or has had someone in the Donegal Hospice or has someone visited at home or even the children that I worked with understand exactly what the Donegal Hospice is. I will come to you in a moment, but Jamie Sweeney joins me now. Paula used the service, your mum used the services of the hospice. Very difficult time, I'm sure, for Paula, for you and the family. But there's something about the hospice that just makes it, I don't know what, I struggle with what the phraseology is, but it makes it a little easier.
Oh, absolutely, Greg. I mean, so for Mum's own situation, so Mum was diagnosed about a year ago, and back in January, her condition got worse, basically. So she was moved to the hospice for a bit of palliative care. And, you know, I suppose from both our perspective as a family, but also for her, there was a real sense of a bit of fear because we were going into the unknown, uncharted territory. But within, obviously, I'd done a bit of work with Isabel in the past, so I knew her, but I didn't know a lot of the staff in the hospice. But within, you know, a few hours of being there, it's the one place nobody wants to be. But when you're there, you're happy you're there because, you know, they just put your mind at rest and, you know, really start to look after you, you know.
Because you can lose people in different ways. There's sudden death, and then there's a sort of a death that you know is coming. And sometimes people will say the latter is more difficult, though it's all difficult, because how do you deal with it? How does Paula deal with it? How does the family deal with it? And I suppose any comfort your mum got and that you can get that she's pain-free, she's content, well, that helps the process, doesn't it?
Absolutely, because, I mean, at that stage, it's all about comfort. It's all about comforting mum, and obviously that, you know, us as a family as well. So, but yeah, I mean, it was, I have to just say that, you know, it was even the simple things like, you know, bringing hairdressers in and stuff like that. That was really, you know, Isabel will tell you, mum loved a good, like, you know, a good getting her hair done. But really just, you know, having access as well. I've got two young kids, so being able to bring them in, and we actually seen that did bring mum a lot of comfort, was having access to those.
But it also helps, it helps with the young people to sort of understand what's going on.
100%.
You know, because it's tough for them. For a lot of young people, the first sense of loss is a grandparent, and it's sort of a kick in the teeth as to the reality of life. Now, people will also know you as part of the fundraising, in fact, the chair of the fundraising team at Fintrue Letterkenny, which has always kind of, or has for the last couple of years, supported the hospice. So your sort of work in supporting the hospice sort of predated your mother ending up using the facilities there.
Absolutely, yeah. So this will be our third full year of supporting the hospice. So delighted to say over the last 2 years we've raised in excess of 25,000.
Amazing.
So that comes directly from our staff and our employees. We do a range of different events, you know, bake sales, charity quizzes, so on and so forth. But that obviously comes from our employees, and the company kindly matched that those donations.
But
as well.
Some of your staff also volunteer with the hospice as well, is that right?
Absolutely, because you know we know things are tough at the moment for people. Not everyone can donate financially, so we also every second Tuesday and Thursday, actually somebody from Fintrue covers the reception at the hospice. So, and again, from being on the other side of the fence to being a family member attending the hospice, that's critical, because you know you're coming in to see your loved one, you know yourself, you know. Getting in quickly can be very important, and having that sort of friendly face. So yeah, we have about 20 of our staff that do that. I think last year we covered every Tuesday, which was about 100 hours for the year. And this year we're aiming to do 200 hours. Yeah. We're covering every second Tuesday.
I think it's really clever too to have a company so to be involved in the community as it is, because it's of the community, and I think that's fantastic. And Isabel, that's Paula's experience and her family's experience, and my condolences. Your mum passed away in March, and even when you know something is coming, you can never truly prepare for when it actually happens, and it's tough. I know it's tough. But again, you know, the Donegal Hospice helps people like Paula and her family. But I mentioned, you know, supporting people in the community, the younger people that maybe people aren't as much aware. There's an awful lot of work going on, and this money's needed for that, Isabel.
Yeah, we also cover COPD and MS. and motor neuron, and we look after the children in the community as well with life limiting conditions. But I would like to thank Jamie for all their help in the last few years and ongoing at the moment. And they also, he forgot to say there that they did the jive for June last year, and it was great crack up there. So
right, so let's get on to how we're going to match these. I don't know. You see, the problem is what's the ceiling? Because of your endeavours, Isabel, the number's going up, it seems, almost every year. Yeah. Fantastic total last year. Yeah. And people can get involved right now, can't they?
They can, of course. They can do their jive and post it. Now, this year I reached out to Glenalla Photography, which is Tracy Marie and Kevin Robinson, and they've already done it. They're posting a jive every day because they're out there and there's a lot of young people jiving, Greg, and they're only too happy to have it on media that they're doing the jive.
Some of them are too bloody good, I
think. But anyway, no, look, at the end of the day, our new build is coming up and we need 6 million for that. So I'm a third there for that. And also then at the end of each May, I need 1.2 to 1.4 million for the running.
Just for the lights. Not literally the lights, but just for the...
Running of the Donegal Hospice.
This is an amazing charity, by the way, whereby, and this is where the money you raise goes into it. There's no cut, there's no this, that and the other.
No.
This is all voluntary fundraising. Every shilling that's earned goes towards the Donegal Hospice, and that's for me what a charity really should be about. So it's in a wonderful charity. There's lots of brilliant charities out there, but this is one of the best. Where's the one-stop shop where people can get more information, Isabel?
Well, Highland Radio, David does the jive every day just after 3 o'clock, just after the news, but there's a good lead up to it.
3:05 time to jive. He won't take on my catchphrase, but that's
we were looking for a catchphrase.
3:05 time to jive. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah,
the news is 5 minutes long.
Yeah,
let's go.
That's right. You better get chatting to him now. Although it's Sinead's on this week, so
she's easy to get around. We'd convince
but
her.
But anyway, and then just post your jive on the Highland Radio and the Donegal Hospice.
Okay, right, brilliant stuff.
And the donate links there.
Please do as much as you can to support Isabel and the team. And Jamie, yous are doing amazing stuff. Thank you so very much indeed for telling us your family story as well. But it also to remind us of the great work Fintrue do all of the time for the Donegal Hospice. Both of you, thank you so very
much. Thank you.
So tune in to Jive Time this afternoon and every afternoon for that matter, but particularly in June, where you can find out more information about Jiving for June, and you can be part of an amazing thing that in 2025 raised €626,000 for this amazing charity, the Donegal Hospice. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9.